morning.
Good morning.
Well, with the children's story I was taking, because it was a sad or a happy ending, but my mind went to realistic or unrealistic ending. If you knew the story from before, the mice had gathered the treasured stones that gave warmth and hollowed out the island, and then the island collapsed upon itself. And sometimes I feel like that's what we can do. We either can empty ourselves out and collapse upon ourselves, or we can empty ourselves out and enrich ourselves. And in this sermon series, the seven deadly sins, I think that is the confrontation, is the hollowing ourselves out or the filling ourselves up. And as I was thinking about the sermon series of the seven deadly sins in the next couple weeks, in the past week, I was reminded that Evagrius, who came up with this list in the fourth century of the seven deadly sins, pride, greed, lust, envy, gluttony, wrath, and sloth, he came up with a very specific idea of what this list was for. This list was for ownership of a reflective process where we look within ourselves, and when the thoughts that led to these behaviors, not the behaviors themselves, but the thoughts that led to the behaviors, were to be confronted within ourselves before they were ever manifested externally. And then I was reading and I found this writing by Peter Bensfield in 1589. And I think this is often typically what we humans do. Here we have an effort by somebody to lead us to internal inner reflection for our own spiritual health and for our well-being, to help keep us centered on that light or on those value systems of which we're oriented. And what he did was he connected a demon to each spiritual sin. Rather than reflecting on our own life, he connected a demon to it. With pride was Lucifer, greed was Mammon, envy was Leviathan, gluttony was Beelzebub, and Satan with wrath, and Belphegor with sloth. And what that alerted me to is our human vulnerability not to own what's truly ours. Our human vulnerability to blame. Our human vulnerability to deflect what is our responsibility onto somebody else. So in the spiritual tradition that he represents, would be one, if I have a thought, rather than confront it and work with what's stimulating that thought within myself, blame it on a demon. Which keeps it external, in a way, because it's a demon, it's not me, it's Satan, Beelzebub, Lucifer, or whoever it might be. So he takes a list from a monastic monk who their whole life is about inner dynamics and inner reflection, takes it and makes it about an external world, which totally defeats the process of the list of the seven deadly sins. But isn't that the nature of our culture today? To externalize what's going on inside of us, rather than to own responsibility of what's going on in ourselves. I mean, there are those who would say if you have one aggressive nation and it provokes another nation to aggressiveness, they become mirror images of each other's inner world, but manifesting it externally, and then they're on their road to mutual death. Mutual mirroring projections. And thinking about that, and I'm wondering, where is that inner reflection and finding what Evagrius and soon we'll talk about chanting, and that inner reflection and finding that peace and that light and that comfort and that well-being within us? I think what that list does by Peter Bensfield of externalizing our inner world, what that does is that collapses the place within us that we engage our spirituality. It shrinks it. It collapses it. For example, when you hear these words, What do you think of, and what goes through your mind? Lord, perfect nature, heavenly witness, transpersonal self, archetype, positive superego, ego ideal, the disciple within, the philosopher's angel, celestial intelligence, the paraclete, the Holy Ghost, Jesus, St. Paul, perfect nature, Sophia, the oracle, divine space, and divine essence. Are these words that describe something that's external to who we are? Or are these words that describe something that comes from within ourselves? Every one of those words that I read are in a tradition of mystical tradition of meditation where people have gone within themselves. And those words describe what they discovered within themselves. But as a person who has been cultured in this world, when I read most of those words, I think external. You say divine, I think external. You say angel, I think external. You say philosopher's angel, I think external. These words move me toward an external understanding, but actually in the spiritual tradition, they're about something within our own world. And when we collapse that spiritual space within ourselves, we have no hope of discovering these aspects of who we are and what it means to be human. The divine nature is something about who we are as human beings. The spiritual, sacred place within ourselves. Evagrius, in the 4th century, did not just appear one day in isolation and say, I think I'll come up with this list so we can check our thoughts. He was in a tradition that was thousands of years old. As a matter of fact, you can trace his thought process to come up with these words and the meditative process of he was protecting his inner self with these words by catching these thoughts back 4,000 years ago to the beginning of the Hindu religion in the Rashi, who were the poets, who in their poetry enlivened their spiritual selves and enlivened that area within us that's their spiritual life. Then out of that community comes this Silk Road, comes trade, comes commerce. And along that Silk Road, from India to the East, to the West, to the Middle East, out of that Silk Road also traveled these thoughts. And then this community called the Therapeutai community, which traveled with these values of honoring this internal reflection, comes the Essenes, comes the Christian monastics. But in that process, and I try to understand how to put things in context, you know, why this inner meditation? How come? We don't have it before, it's not everywhere. But why this inner meditation that we can trace back to 4,000 years ago to the beginning of Hinduism, through Buddhism, through Judaism, to the Essene community, to the Christian monastics, to the desert church fathers, why this eternal dynamic? And I thought it would be important to think, you just don't look at a line through history to understand who we are spiritually, we also have to put it in context. And when we put this in context, what we discover is, and we have mentioned before the name of Daniel Quinn, and I don't know if you are familiar with Daniel Quinn, but he kind of helps us understand the evolution of culture. And when we put this in context, we begin to understand that at the same time the Hindu religion started, this inner work by the mystics started, at the same time we see civilization begin to grow, and we see more people come on the earth, we see cities beginning to get tighter, and all of a sudden we begin to see for the first time standing armies, military aggression, political process, we begin to see for the first time the sense of crime, as we never understood crime before, corruption, counterfeiting. So as the commerce is traveling along the Silk Road, not only are the thoughts of this spirituality traveling along the Silk Road and these trade routes, but also the values of a culture that has corruption, dominance, and oppression that goes along with it. So in the external world, the values are beginning to value acquisition, power, oppression. Slavery becomes an industry, the enslavement of other people, military conquest, Alexander the Great, Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, Assyria, Persia. So you're having these military conquests, and at the same time, you're having this shadow side, the mystics nurturing their inner world. And I'm reading the characteristics of the mystics community, and there's where you find compassion, there's where you find love, there's where you find the drive for justice. And I begin to ask myself, can I see any government that was ever anchored in these values in the past several thousand years? A government that was genuinely anchored in the sense of love and in the sense of compassion, the sense of spiritual pilgrimage that traveled along with Howard, and I can't find it. There it is. It's our storyteller. Matt Meiser called
us. It's
the saints are marching in, so we're kind of close.
So here we have, coming through time, for the past 4,000 years, 6,000 years really, you have two streams of thought. You have this mystical thought, this sense of where love and the sense of where compassion comes from within us, but you also have in the expression of that, these people who are involved in that kind of spirituality, nurturing their inner world where they find this angel, guardian angel, higher consciousness, where they find this sense of peace and are finding the disciples within, and as we'll get to in a minute in William Ellery Channing's work, they find the oracle within, one of the founders of Unitarianism in our country, the oracle within ourselves and having to pay attention to that oracle. But at the same time, you also find this tightening of control in our culture. When crime was first becoming a thing, not just border crossings, but crime, counterfeiting, and corruption, you find something very curious. You find that's also the same time that we begin to write things down, that when literature started. And the correlation is, once you began to write things down, you could begin to write laws down. And once you could begin to write laws down, you could create a process of conformity or a process of manipulation to move people to become exactly who you want them to be in their relationship to the law. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't be this, you can't say that, you can't... Right? So we have these laws tightening the imaginative processes of people of who they can and who they cannot be. And over here in the spiritual realm, you have these mystics who are moving past what they would call an illusion, or moving past what they would call do not be conformed to this world. They're moving past that into a space where there is boundlessness, where love knows no bounds, where compassion knows no bounds. There is no sense of identity formation that would match the culture. In the mystical world, you move past that. And then you have to re-enter that and be involved in it somehow. What I found really, I guess I kind of grieved or found sad, is that along that Silk Road, you had these communities where if you were caught up in that world that was emerging, that culture that was emerging at that particular point, you could stop at one of those communities and either join it and live there, and that would be your life. And I thought, sometimes in my life that would be nice if I could just stop and join a community and live there and be part of that community and not participate in the world where I have to work to pay taxes, to belong to conform to be commercialized. Give me a break. Can I get out of this? You know, is there any way to step out of this? Well, along the Silk Road, there were ways. There were communities that you could join. But you know, as much as we like the word freedom, you stop working and you don't pay taxes, you're in trouble. So I began to wonder, how does our culture deal with those dissidents or those who notice this is not a healthy culture that we live in and I'd like to do something different and really try to do something different? Beg or act them? I don't know. Hospitalize, drug, pharmaceuticals. I mean, what will our culture do to make your imaginative process conform so that you would be acceptable? Addictions, codependencies normalized, shame-based culture. I mean, how many of us have been ashamed of our country and culture in the past 10, 20, 30 years? I mean, literally, ashamed. You know, so we get ashamed. And when we're responding to a psychologically sick culture, that imaginative process, that place of that spiritual well-being shrinks. That light that is within us shrinks and gets darker the more we pay attention to that. So if we're not nurturing that aspect of ourselves, if we're not taking care of that aspect of ourselves, the shrinking of that part of who we are as spiritual beings will just occur as we move through time in this culture. If we are passive about our spiritual selves. And I look at my own life and I think, do I practice a spiritual discipline? And I think, oh yeah, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. You know, other eras in my time I did, but maybe now I don't. But do we practice a spiritual discipline? You know, do we unconsciously practice a discipline that shrinks that light, that divine essence, that perfect nature, who we are as human beings? Do we unconsciously and passively participate in a life that shrinks that part of ourselves? I think if we're not careful, we do. So it does take active spiritual discipline, or it does take some time for us to stop and remove ourselves from this world in some way to nurture that part of ourselves, or it does shrink away. I mean, when we have to hear a president say, we do not torture? What in the world's going on in our culture that was necessary? We all cheered when he said it and said, okay. Why in the world was it necessary for him to even say that we don't torture? When there was a time in our culture where we had some, I think, healthy sense of pride that we were, maybe it was an illusion, I don't know, healthy sense of pride that we were more of a compassionate and kind culture. And when we lose that, do I find myself distracted with that list of the seven deadly sins when I go through them? Do I become a gluttonous to hear the bad news of the day? Does my life get distracted by paying attention to the things that are against my values and trying to figure out ways to stand up over and against them and transform those values so that they're more toward the way I believe things ought to be? And I spend my life doing that, and the next thing I know, 20 years has gone by and nothing's different. And my life has been wasted. And if you remember the story of Buddha, when he was being groomed as the son of the king to be king, and he looked at the kingdom and he saw the injustice in the kingdom and the poverty in the kingdom and the suffering in the kingdom, and he looked at it and he said, even when I will be king, because of the politics, because of the corruption in the story of compassion in that part of his life, he said, even when I'm king, I will not be able to change this. The only way to change this is to change the hearts and minds of people, not the policies of government. And he left and gave up his position, his future position as king, and gave up and began to and started these monastic communities. My tension within myself today is, what do we stay in and work with the system that we have, Or do we start some kind of community because there's no hope for this? But the only hope is really to change the hearts and the minds of people, but we're caught up in a system where we're always over and against the values that we feel bad about or that we don't want and that we don't like and that really promote values that promote a sense of injustice. And as I said last time, values that actually honor the seven deadly sins. Corruption, greed. If you have $1 billion, we admire you, and we don't care how you got it. You're a hero in our culture. When they called Solomon the wisest man that ever lived, he enslaved people. He had people do forced labor. He was an arms trader. I mean, he was very similar to that. We really haven't come very far in that. We'll have to do William Ellery Channing next time to compare to this. We'll get right there. To see how, and if you'd like, this next couple weeks, go read Spiritual Freedom, and you can find William Ellery Channing's list of how to protect your mind, just like you look at the seven deadly sins and understand that evagrius, that monastic, he was making a list to protect his spiritual mind, his mystic discoveries. That's what that list was about. And if you read Spiritual Freedom of William Ellery Channing, he's also got his list of what you need to do to protect that mystical experience, in which he did have a mystical experience that drove his ministry that we'll get into next time. But the emphasis of my surprise at looking at the seven deadly sins and the purpose of them is that how much we need to be aware of our inner world and the thoughts that occur in our inner world, and how we need to confront the thoughts of our inner world in order to stay centered where we want to be if we're going to be congruent with our values. That's where the struggle is. Muhammad came back from a battle, a great victory, and sat down with the leaders, captains, lieutenant generals, whoever they were. And he said, now we begin the real war. We're going to look inside ourselves. And that's where we are today. We're in a culture that would move us away from looking inside ourselves, but we know to be the best and healthiest spiritual beings we can be, that is where we need to go. It's within ourselves. That is where the kingdom is, that is where the peace is, that is where the joy is, that is where the light is. And once we access those aspects of ourselves, then we can give out our values in this world with some integrity.